After 10 or 11 years in the preaching business, I've come to that point in my career where I now get to sit back from time to time and listen to new or beginning preachers. I am sorely tempted to say that Jesus, in his first sermon, makes a classic rookie preacher's error. You see, Jesus goes prophetic on the congregation. In this classic rookie preacher's error, going prophetic means scolding the congregation for their greed or their arrogance or their indifference or their hard-heartedness or some other grievous sin which the newly minted preacher has perceived after 1 week on the job. Believing themselves called to be prophetic, to speak the truth, to give the people what for on behalf of God, these rookies throw the sermonic equivalent of Molotov cocktails from the pulpit, generating generally less light than heat. Well, as I say, Jesus, in his first sermon, goes all prophetic on the congregation, telling his friends and neighbors that God welcomes outsiders. And in so doing, he uses two powerful sermon illustrations. Both the widow at Zarephath in Sidon and Naaman the Syrian are just about as outside as you can get. The widow was a woman on the outside of a male-dominated society. As a widow, she was on the outside of an economy that was open only to men. As a resident of Sidon in Phoenicia, she was on the outside of a geopolitical border that labeled her a foreign national. She was also on the outside of a religious border that named her a pagan. Naaman the Syrian fared a little better because he was a man and he was his nation's highest ranking general. But from an Israelite's point of view, he was every bit as much the outsider that the widow was. As a Syrian, he too was on the outside of a geopolitical border that named him not only a foreign national, but also the chief foreign enemy. He too was on the outside of a religious border that labeled him both a pagan and an unclean person, owing to the skin disease from which he suffered. From the point of view of Jesus' audience, then, the widow of Sidon and Naaman the Syrian were both on the outside looking in, putting the people of the Nazareth synagogue, these children of Israel, these people of the covenant, on the inside looking out. And though they might not have agreed, I think these two groups, outsiders and insiders, have two things in common: fear and hope. The outsiders feared for their lives. The widow was an unemployed and unemployable single mother, struggling to feed herself and her son in the midst of a drought that was dragging on for 3.5 years. But she wasn't the only one who was struggling. As Jesus himself pointed out, there were many widows in Israel in the time of Elijah. They faced the same circumstances. They asked the same question about how they would feed their families. And yet Elijah, one of Israel's greatest prophets who brought down fire from the heavens and parted the Jordan River, was sent to none of them. If charity begins at home, Elijah didn't get the memo. If we take care of our own first, Elijah didn't get the message. And he didn't because God sent Elijah not to care for the folks at home, not to pastor the flock. God sent Elijah rather to an outsider. Naaman, too, feared for his life. Despite his high rank and the access to quality health care that afforded him. Naaman was afflicted with leprosy, the moral and social equivalent of AIDS in his day and time. Leprosy, which was a catch-all term for a variety of skin diseases, wouldn't kill you necessarily, but you might as well be dead. No one would come near you for fear of catching the disease you had. The law in Israel prohibited lepers from normal human interaction, pushing lepers to the very margins of human society. And there were many lepers in the time of Elisha, Elijah's protege, a prophet who in his own right multiplied loaves to feed a crowd, who cured men of their blindness. But Elisha received no orders to cure Israelite lepers. Elisha saw no Israelites in his one-man clinic. The only person to knock on Elisha's door was Naaman the Syrian. And Naaman came only under much duress. He could think of lots of reasons to seek healing from someone other than Elisha. He could get the therapy back home in better facilities. Back home, the doctors would come to call on him, not the other way around. Even when he did go to Elisha's clinic, the prophet refused to see the patient, sending the prescription for a cure through an assistant instead. Though many Israelites were in need, it was a Syrian who was healed. The people in the congregation that day would have been only too familiar with the stories, and they would not have liked them. Consequently, the reaction to Jesus' sermon was only too predictable. And not having the convenience of a pastor-parish relations committee to whom to complain, people took matters in their own hands, rising up and dragging Jesus out of the pulpit, taking him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built in an attempt to end his preaching career almost before it had begun. The people of the Nazareth synagogue were not a happy congregation that day because Jesus had gone all prophetic on them. He had tried to reflect something to them that was uncomfortable about themselves. Jesus had tried to tell them and us something about who we are. Jesus had dared to tell a congregation the truth. Jesus had ventured to tell the very religious community that had loved and raised him the truth. The truth about their pettiness and their prejudice, their fear and shame, their resistance to outsiders, their inability to think that God's salvation might be broader than how they had previously conceived it. But I'm sympathetic to that congregation, sympathetic that Jesus had to get all prophetic on them. I think what the people in that congregation didn't remember or perhaps couldn't see was just how scared these outsiders must have been when salvation came their way. If it's scary for us to think about inviting people to join us for worship, as I have asked us to do, think about how scary it must be for outsiders to be invited. What must women think if the only church they know has been dominated by men? What must people who are single or single parents feel if the only church they see has been populated by couples? What must people who are unemployed imagine if the church to which they are invited is full of happy, busy, working people? What must people who are forced to society's margins by circumstance, be it illness of mind or body, or awkwardness of manners or speech, or poverty of spirit or resources, what must these wonder if they are invited inside a church that is full of perfect-looking, perfect-acting people. Don't you imagine they must be afraid for their lives? Ironically, I think the people on the inside looking out, namely you and me, share the same fear. We're almost scared. Fear runs rampant across the United Methodist Church, indeed across most Protestant mainline denominations. We are afraid for our very lives. We are afraid that we might not exist in a generation or two as membership declines due to death and defection, as professions of faith dwindle, as bureaucratic inertia threatens to engulf whatever energy and vitality might come to us through new people and new ideas. I think local churches fear outsiders, however outsiders are defined, because the people of those churches fear losing their sense of identity, their sense of community, of who we are, of what we've been. That might come under threat if we welcome in the outsider who might ask us to be different. Too many once proud inner city white churches are afraid of the racial and ethnic minority neighbors who now live nearby. Too many older churches are afraid of young people who sport tattoos or play loud music or who communicate better electronically than person to person. Too many doctrinally pure churches are afraid of people who think or believe or worship differently than they do. Of course, every church has its own story about who they are, about the great preachers who have served there, about the buildings they've built, about the missions they've done, about the fellowship suppers enjoyed. These stories, that culture is vital for every healthy congregation. But if and when you fear losing that sense of identity, that sense of community, then you become resistant to change. And when the winds of change stop blowing, if the Spirit of God stops stirring things up, then the local church is in danger of becoming stagnant or even stale. But the second thing that those on the outside looking in and those on the inside looking out have in common is hope. Surely the widow at Zarephath in Sidon hoped that someone would come to the rescue, hoped that someone would offer her life-saving bread, hoped that someone would offer her a word of encouragement, hoped that someone could give her a glimmer of hope. Surely Naaman the Syrian hoped that someone would suggest a cure for his illness, hoped that someone would provide a remedy for his suffering, hoped that someone would speak a word of promised relief, hoped that someone would give him a reason to go on. Of course, people who are afraid for their very lives are the very people who look for salvation, for deliverance, for help, for rescue, for hope. And they usually aren't particular about where that hope comes from. I'd like to suggest to us this morning that there are people out there who need our help, and their situations are sufficiently well known to us. We respond to their need every week through our offering and through the Vision for Change. But I think there are also folk out there who need hope, whose situations may not be as well known to us, may in fact be hidden from us. Who among our neighbors hopes to make a new start? Is it someone who has recently moved to Dallas? Is it someone who has changed jobs, someone who is trying again after a divorce or death? Who among our neighbors hopes to belong? Is it someone who too often is rejected as a student, an employee, an artist, a dreamer, a lover, a friend? Who among our neighbors hopes to make a contribution? Is it a young person with plenty of talent but few opportunities? Is it the person with questions looking for a safe place to ask them? Is it someone who may not have a lot of treasure but has a lot of time and an inclination to make a difference? When people bring their hopes to God, God's people have the opportunity to be their chance to start over, their community to which to belong, their place to make a difference, their chance to offer themselves. And as God's people, I think we too have hopes. We hope that people will find us. We hope that when they find us, these outsiders will like us and maybe even love us. We hope that they will learn our story and appreciate our traditions and learn the way we do things. But I like to think that we can hope as well that we will learn to do things in new ways, that we will learn other people's stories, that we will appreciate new traditions. I'd like to think that as people come to us, we will like them and even love them. Even more, I'd like to think that we hope not simply to wait for others to come to us, but knowing what we know, being released as we have been released, having had our eyes opened, that we're so excited about what God is doing among us that we go out to find the lost, that we go out to make a part of our community those who have been pushed to the margins, that we go out to serve those who are in need and looking for a second chance. Brothers and sisters, I believe that we can do this and do it in confidence because the Spirit of the Lord is upon us. The Spirit of the Lord has anointed us, you and me, to be and to proclaim God's good news to the world. And so may the good news that has saved us and made us insiders be just as real in us and through us for those on the outside looking in.